Hey, everybody. Thanks for listening to Shop Talk Show. We have two awesome sponsors this week. Our longtime sponsor, Environments for Humans. The most important one they have coming up is the RWD Summit, Responsive Web Design Summit. Go to rwdsummit.com. That's an online conference coming up April 16th through 18th. Dave is going to be there. It's going to be awesome. And our sponsor, Lynda.com. You probably heard of Lynda. Tons of videos. I was just on their website this morning. 1,689 different courses. Go to lynda.com/shoptalk. And you get your first week free, which is pretty cool. We'll tell you more about both of those later in the show, but for now, let's kick things off.
It needs an explosion right at the end. Like,
yeah.
Boom. Hey, welcome. Shop Talk Show, podcast about sound effects and web design. And I'm Dave Rupert, and this is episode 62.
Two.
Chris.
Hi, everybody.
We have with Chris us. Chris Coyer, yeah. If you don't know him. Okay, who we got today, Chris?
Brandon Mathis. Thanks for joining us, Brandon.
Hey, everybody. I'm delighted to be here.
Yay.
I gotta say, it's funny. I listen to the show all the time and I really like it. And the problem with being on the show, having listened to it a bunch, is I slip into podcast, I'm listening to it mode. And so when the intro plays, I'm just like, oh, okay, cool. I'm listening to this show. And I forget I'm about to have to talk on it. So
you're going to have to respond.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Indeed.
That's, sure. It's okay.
So I think I first met Brandon ever. I'm trying to remember, but I think it was a LessConf, right?
Like that's correct.
Three years ago-ish, maybe? Maybe less, maybe more. I can't remember. But it was a while because Brandon was the first person ever to show me SAS and how it works. So yeah. I think you had like some kind of buttons mix in, perhaps? Or I got it. Was that you that did that way back in the day?
You're remembering correctly. It was Fancy Buttons, which is...
Fancy Buttons.
Early CSS3 button plugin for Compass.
Would you call him your Sassensei?
Sassensei. Oh, no.
Oh. Web puns for days.
Shoot. I feel guilty about that one. Like, genuinely kind of guilty. All right.
Anyway, it was interesting. And it took a while after that for me to use it more earnestly. But it was, I remember, a very compelling demo of how it can all go down. When I had my doubts, I'm sure you remember.
Yeah, I remember it was especially related to having to deal with the command line, and it just seemed like a lot of hassle to set it up. But things have come along.
We don't do it so much anymore. Yeah, right. That's a big deal. That's part of the deal. Actually, I was having a big conversation on Twitter last night with a bunch of people, just kind of like, is there any like still haters out there? I know there's like few, there's not that many left, but there's still a good amount. And I was trying to gather like as many of the like legit reasons why people don't, and it seems like the most common one still is that like workflow complication thing,
right?
Which, what are you gonna do?
I mean, you might as well have the same argument about why you don't want to use Git or anything else that helps you do a better job.
Yeah.
I mean, not to like trash people who are saying otherwise. I'm just saying it's sure. some complications at this point are kind of, that's what you have to do in order to do best practices. And, like working locally and then deploying remotely, that kind of stuff.
Yeah. Yep. And, so I don't know, all judgment aside, some of that stuff is more legit than others, but whatever. That's not where I wanted to go necessarily, but you're maybe a little bit though. You are a Compass team member. Is that the deal?
That's correct.
But not SAS. Those are different teams, right?
Right.
Kind of.
Right. Yeah. I think for the SAS team, you have to be a lot more into Ruby. And so they, cause they just do crazy stuff that I would not understand. But for Compass, I can help with the website, work on CSS3 mix-ins and other stuff.
Sure. What was the last thing that was kind of happening in Compass land? It seems like it doesn't need like daily maintenance, because it only needs really changed when browser implementations change and when specs change,
Yeah, that never happens. Yeah, keeping up with that is important. There's actually what we're working on right now, and I'm not working on it as much as Scott Davis, but he's trying to get it where it's a lot easier to install Compass plugins, like with, you know, NPM and RubyGems has a nice system for distributing and installing and handling dependencies and everything. He would really like it if Compass kind of worked like a front end system for that. You know, for people who use Compass, they can just easily share not just SAS, but also JavaScript, HTML, those kind, anything that goes in with that front end package, and even Ruby on the back end that makes things work. So you could package up really nice extensions and easily install them from the command line or from something else. The extensions like already work that way
for your front end project or whatever.
Yeah, basically.
Which is, so what's kind of interesting about that is you never even see that stuff, you know, like on your Rails project, how many gems do you use? Just like a zillion, you know, or, you know, like 20 or something on an average all project, wouldn't you say, you know? And you just never even see that code.
Gem install star.
Yeah, and the thing with the front end that makes it more challenging is a lot of times, you know, if you're working in Rails, then yeah, you can put different things in the vendor directories and or throw them in each of the asset places where they need to be. But if you're working on a standalone project, you also want to have access to those. And so kind of that's a really nice thing that Compass does, is provide you an integration with like whatever framework you're using. And if it's standalone, then it needs to know, okay, you know, in the configuration, you can say, this is where my style sheets, this is where my JavaScript, this is where my templates go. And so when you install an extension, it can just copy that stuff from the extension into the places where they belong, so you can start using it right away. And this is already possible. We're just looking at hopefully having a centralized repository so people can publish their extensions to that and download them from it.
That's the first I've heard of it. That sounds pretty cool.
That's because it's really hard and we don't really talk about it because we don't want people to get their hopes up.
What's the deal with animations in Compass? Like, when's that?
I am already using that on the 13.1 beta stuff. So you can, okay. Or maybe it's 13.0, I don't remember. But yeah, you can use that. You can even copy out those from, like, if you want to use the current one, for some reason your gems require you to do that or whatever. You can
pretty much just
go grab the source and steal it. I've done that on a project before too.
So you just plop that in some sort of mixin file or whatever, and then I'm good to go. Rock and rolling
thereabouts. Okay, off the top of my head, it's pretty close to that.
So what they're talking about, just for background for people that have no idea, right, is that you might, you know, a lot of people use Compass/CSS3 for help writing CSS3 stuff, and like it has everything in there. So, you know, you think of gradients and transforms and transitions and all this stuff that you need to prefix. For whatever reason, as of now, there's no mixin for animation or keyframes. And so that's what's being fixed, possibly, or there was probably a reason why it wasn't there. It's not, you know, because it was weird. And
right, you can just write your keyframes once with Compass's mixin. I can't off the top of my head remember the way it works, because usually those are just, you know, you put them together in a library, get them how they're working, but you don't use them all the time. You just kind of reference them later. But yeah, you just write out the keyframe exactly how you would want to, and Compass automatically does all of the.
It's really, right?
It's so smart.
That's going to work.
Yeah, because you just write out the keyframe, and then Compass will go in and prefix everything that needs to be prefixed, and output separate blocks of keyframes for each one that needs to.
So, like in the WebKit in the Dash WebKit keyframes, it won't. What about, like, does it work with all its own mixins? It probably does, right? So, like, if there's a transform in there, it will only output the WebKit transform in the WebKit keyframes.
Yes, and I tell you what, if you look at the...
Oh my goodness.
That's a huge update too, because all of the CSS3 mixins have to be updated to understand their context. And so if they're inside of one of these things, they know, okay, I need to really just output the right vendor prefix for where I am. So it was crazy hard, but it turns out awesome.
Yeah, wow. That's very cool.
Right. That was one of those reasons why...
I think I messed that up.
It makes it so much easier to use this stuff. Like, I absolutely love it.
Yeah, that's got to go stable. Vote plus one.
Very
let's go.
Cool. Awesome.
Cool. So speaking of side project-y stuff, Compass is a big thing that you work on. Octopress is another one, which is a static site generator, which is a topic that comes up fairly often on the show. Do you want to give us a background on what that is quick?
Sure, yeah. Basically, a long time ago, I was redesigning a WordPress site for myself. This was in summer of 2009, I think. Anyway, and I was just really getting tired of, at that time, the, you know, you just get a template and you change it and you make it look how you want it to. And you probably still do that now. I haven't done it in forever. But the layouts were, I mean, so much was repetitive. It wasn't using partials. It was just awful. And most of the stuff that I came across, again, best practices have changed now with WordPress, I imagine. But and I was just getting really frustrated because I ended up spending all my time trying to work on plugins and do things that I didn't really need to be doing. And so I thought, at that time, I discovered Jekyll, which is a thing from Tom Preston Warner, the founder of GitHub, co-founder, I guess. And it was just static site generator, basically, that understood blogs. And so you can put all your posts in one directory and then put pages somewhere else. And it'll generate the, you know, it'll basically gives you loops. So you can loop through posts and it creates, it handles the permalink structure. And it ends up rendering it all to just HTML files. And so the nice thing about that is you can deploy it to pretty much anywhere that can have a public facing directory and your site will work. If you have a decent server, it'll cache things properly and you can't get fireballed. You know, it's just a really nice way to manage a site. The thing is you have to build it locally and deploy it though. And I was like, well, that's fine with me.
It's a little nerdier.
It didn't bother me at all. I thought, wow, I can, you know, it was funny. At one point, I was deployed on Dreamhost and they were having some trouble. And so within like 5 minutes, somebody tweeted out to me, hey, the Octopress site is down. So I went ahead and just redeployed over to GitHub Pages, moved my DNS, and it was there immediately. It was, you know, because I didn't have some database and a bunch of other things I had to manage, like it's your downtime can be negligible. And, you know, if I had monitoring services like Pingdom or something, I would have had it faster than that, but I didn't see the tweet for a while. So anyway, so yeah, the static sites are really cool for that kind of thing. And so I started working with Jekyll, but there's all kinds of setup because it's really just a generator. It didn't have any templates by default, didn't have any automation. So you end up having to type all these commands. And so I wrote a little rake task to automate that. So you could say like rake generate and it will generate your blog. And then you can say rake new post and it will create the file in the right directory with the right date string and everything else. And then I started working on templates for that. And then Chris Epstein, the Compass creator, saw my blog and it had some of these things built into it. And he goes, hey man, and I had it up on GitHub. He said, hey, is it okay if I fork your blog and hack it around and make something out of it? I was like, oh yeah, sure, go ahead. And then while he was working on that, that's kind of when he discovered, I think that's how I ended up working on Compass because he really liked what I was doing. And nice. But yeah, after him forking my blog, I was like, this might be useful to other people too. I should really make this not just my blog that you have to fork if you want all this cool stuff. So I ended up working on Octopress and then I released that at LessConf, actually, the first one. And then it's just been working on it ever since. Yeah.
It's been pretty popular, huh? I mean, I would say it's wildly popular, yeah.
Yeah, disturbingly popular is even.
Maybe. Yeah. Every developer who does not use Google Plus uses Octopress, it would seem.
I tell you what, I love when I'm looking for the solution to a problem and I wind up on an Octopress blog and it's like they help me, I help them. So I always,
nice.
One of the things that I think, and I don't know how many other people do this, but especially because I notice a lot when I end up on an Octopress blog, if somebody, you know, is writing about something that solves a problem for me, I always try to tweet out to him and say, hey man, this blog post you wrote really helped me out. Thanks a bunch for it. And I just encourage everybody in general, if somebody writes something that helps you, tell them because it, you know, encouraging other people is a huge part about like why I do what I do. And why other people, you know, want to excel and share code.
Hold on, Brandon. Positivity on the web?
Are you sure? Oh, man, what was I thinking? You're right.
Being positive? Why would you? I mean, I guess.
But, you know, it's funny. Just go ahead, Chris.
Oh, no. Yeah, I'm sure it's more important.
Oh, I was going to say, just I think it was yesterday, somebody at Web Design Toots Plus did this super long, beautiful post about how to get started with Octopress. Screenshots, diagrams, like all kinds of crazy time they put into it. And it just feels amazing to see people dedicating that kind of time to something that I created. And it's like, you know, I just imagine them sitting there banging their head against the wall trying to figure out how to describe something well. And I just know how much time it takes to do documentation. And yet this guy just did this beautiful long post.
Nice.
And then other people.
So this is the go-to if you want to get started post now all of a sudden.
Yeah, it's pretty. I'd say it's really good to go for. I'll get you a link for the show notes later.
I have it. I'm already looking at it.
Cool.
Yeah, they're doing pretty good work over at Web Design Tuts Plus.
I've noticed.
Tuts. Yeah, that's right.
It is Tuts, but come on, it's a tutorial. You toot.
Okay.
As far as I'm concerned, it's tooting. This is a sound effect podcast.
Okay. So that was the best explanation I've heard of it, because I've, you know, have known of Jekyll and Octopress and stuff for a while now, but I didn't quite understand the difference. Is it built on top of Jekyll? Okay. So
yes, it's a framework for Jekyll pretty much.
So it gives you all this stuff like a theme and build tools and stuff. So you might as well just use Octopress. It would be weird almost.
Well, so here's the thing. We are on the cusp of a 3.0 release. And for a long time, it's been called 2.1, and this is the first time I've really talked about it publicly. I have learned so much about maintaining an open source project from this. Right now, we have 1,076 closed issues and 86 open issues. Every day, I get tons of email from developers who are sending me code improvements and, you know, discussing different best practices for things. Mm-hmm. And so it's, you know, for a thing that one guy is running. I did just recently add Parker Moore, who's an awesome Ruby guy, and he's helping me out with this stuff. But, you know, historically, it's been mostly me. To have all these people constantly sending me stuff, it's like just to review their code and decide, is this good code? Is it not? Like, oh, it's just so much effort. And but it's also has taught me so much. Like in the next version that we're releasing in 3.0, we're going to have all the best practices for front end compilation, like fingerprinting, and, you know, compile all your JavaScript together, so that you do good cache busting and all that kind of stuff. And so when people come to it, they can like, if they want to do some JavaScript, they can just dump them into a directory. If they write modular JavaScript, that already works. They put it in the modules directory. If they have something like jQuery, they want it to be global, they can put it in the lib directory. And it does the correct order, and you can specify the order in the configs, and it compiles it all nicely. It's really great. We're using StitchRB for that. And of course, you can do CoffeeScript and all kinds of cool stuff.
So it's kind of like your own personal asset pipeline.
Yes, actually.
People are familiar.
Pretty much had to write that for Octopress from scratch because we wanted it to work a certain way for things. And then I'm working on making it so you can write themes and plugins and just install them from a gem or a GitHub repository, and it'll put everything in the right place. So another kind of plugin system that makes it a lot easier. Like, you know, you put a manifest with your plugin that tells all the files that it has and default configurations, so people can just override that when they install it. So, I mean, it'd be a lot easier for people to use once we have this out, because it's less like some guy's blog with a theme already that you fork, and more like a system for building a static blog on top of Jekyll.
Yeah, yeah. Well, cool.
I always feel bad for guys like you that work so hard. It's like you work on a huge web app, and it's actually even harder than working on a normal web app, because you have the whole world submitting issues to you and having to deal with that. And then it's just for no money.
Yeah. Right. Well, people.
I make tiny jQuery plugins and I cry myself to sleep.
Wow. I did hear about the letter.
Is there some kind of business you can run from this or not? Or you don't even want to?
So actually, it's funny you had mentioned that, because, you know, I know that at the end there's usually a how can people give you money and contact you and all that kind of stuff. There is actually something that I'm considering doing. It's called GitTip. Have you guys heard of that?
Yeah. But that, I mean, no, are people going to actually use it? It's just an optional, like, oh, you'd. Thanks for this thing. Here's a dollar.
Right. The thing is, it's interesting about GitTip is it is anonymous and it's recurring. So people can support a project on an ongoing basis if they want to. And the difference is I've usually declined donations up until this point. People have emailed me and asked me or tweeted to me, hey, how can I donate? You help me out with this. And I just say, yeah, I don't really want to take money for this. And I think it's interesting because when I do this work, I don't want to feel like I owe something to somebody. And so like having people pay for something, if I'm,
that might make it more stressful to
yeah,
you.
Yeah. I didn't want it to feel that kind of pressure of, man, this guy just gave me some money and now I feel like I need to do this thing. But then I kind of realized that some people contribute code and some people contribute money. And, you know, it's sad to decline people's generosity as long as it's, you know, on good terms. And that's the cool thing about, GitTip is because it's anonymous, you don't have the same pressure. It's sort of like, wow, I don't know who's giving me this money, but it looks clever. Like there's a lot of people in this community who are doing that. There's some projects that are nicely supported.
Maybe you could just sell themes, you know, because that's like it's almost like the icing on the cake for that kind of thing. But there's so much like precedent for theme selling.
Yeah. The really tough thing about that, and this is actually the tough thing about running this project at all, is that everybody has a different opinion of what a blog should do. And, you know, it's like they want to integrate this plugin or that plugin or some social network you've never heard of. And, I would be terrified to work at WooThemes or some of those kind of places where you have this to start off offering something that people like, you have to have all of this stuff. And, I kind of want everything to be pretty minimal. And if people want their own stuff, they can add it. And I just want to make it easy for them to do that, really. And then I don't want to, selling themes is tricky because then you get the whole, well, I want a refund. This didn't do what I thought it did. The pictures looked good and you have to hide source and I don't know.
Totally.
I'm just happy to
I don't do support on them, but still.
Right. I'm happy to do donations and long term. Yeah. And we'll do t-shirts at some point once I get a good design for that.
It's no money in t-shirts. I'm telling you. Yeah, $50.
It's terrible.
For one of those.
I just think how fun it would be if I got to wear an Octopress shirt to a conference. And if I'm going to wear one, I'm sure other people would like to too. So that's really, it has nothing to do with making money.
Yeah. Cool. All right. I didn't mean to like totally go there. I just wanted
to. No, that's cool.
We want you to do good. Cause right now you have to work. You have to go to Mongo HQ, right? Isn't that where you work?
Yeah.
Yep.
Which that's is not like, too bad though.
No, that's awesome. I love it there.
Yeah. That's sweet.
It's funny. That's one of the things, being a designer who works for developers, that's what I'm already doing with Octopress and getting to do that, to be paid to do that. It's fun. It's really fun to support that community for me. And I think it's, I've worked on, I did 7 years of freelance contracting and I worked mostly on Rails apps. And I've seen so many different things that you could build and design. And it's like, you're kind of betting on usually a model of social interaction to make sense. Like somebody has to have really solved that problem and figured it out. And you're kind of like, okay, as the designer, how can I make this easy for people to do whatever it is that the founder has come up with as, this is our make it or break it. Is it going to work? And then, or it's like a business rule. Like you're working on some kind of membership management system or some, e-commerce thing. Like it's all like the problem you're trying to solve at its core for those things is based on whoever decided that was the problem. Like, can you solve that? And so like, I feel like I'm just getting the UI end of it. It's kind of fun to work with like a problem for developers because, with Mongo HQ, we're taking database management and trying to make that easier for people. And it's a lot easier to have it feels more scientific to have a measurement of have we improved this process? Because the process is already defined by the technologies people are using, like the way that you query MongoDB. So we say, how can we make it easier for people to query MongoDB in a browser? How can we work on a CLI for them to be able to do these things? And it's like taking this known problem and trying to hide the awful parts of it and make it beautiful and make it fun to use. So that's why I like working for developers.
Boom. Sweet.
Yeah, I'm going to post that in there. It's funny. I've seen there's some beautiful Mongo HQ stuff that you've shown me too, but like, it's hidden a little bit when you go to the homepage.
Oh yeah. See, I haven't worked on the, any of the public facing stuff yet. I mostly do the app.
Yeah.
I do have a couple of dribbles up there. People can check out.
All right. Cool. Let me do a sponsor quick. There's a lynda.com is back as a sponsor. So LYNDA, right? Most people have heard of this, but go to lynda.com/shoptalk and it will actually, it will set a cookie. So even if you like can't do it right now and feel like coming to sign up for Lynda later, that cookie will be there and it will give you your free week. So just go right now, go to lynda.com/shoptalk so you can get that cookie set. So make sure you get your free week when you do sign up. Like I said, at the top of the show, I just went and looked at the homepage just for fun to see. Because there's over 77,000 videos is what they told us they have, but it's broken up into 1,689 courses. It's just a mind-boggling amount of courses. There's no way you could ever watch everything on Lynda. It would just do, it's longer than your lifetime long, which is pretty cool. What was I going to say? Just at the bottom here, it's not just web learning. Here's some courses: Photoshop CS6 one-on-one fundamentals, WordPress essential training, foundations of photography composition, Excel 2013 training, tons of stuff. So there's all these different courses you can take, web specific stuff and just all kinds business stuff, all kinds of stuff. So check out lynda.com/choptalk for all your kind of learning needs. Really cool.
Should we kick things off and get into the meat and taters of the Shop Talk show? Questions and answers. Does that sound good?
Oh, yeah. Let's do it.
The first question is an audio question, and let's cue it up here. Comes from Brad Tunisnard. I did not do a very good job on that one. Here we go. So it's about Compass and stuff like that. So here we go.
What's up, Shop Talk Show? Got a question for Brandon about Compass Sprites. Every time I save the SAS file, it regenerates the sprites. So it takes 30, 40 seconds to generate my CSS so I can test every time. And the best workaround I've found was to isolate the sprite code in a separate SAS file and generate a separate CSS file and then just use a CSS at import to import that CSS. But of course, this adds another HTTP request, so that's not great. So I was just wondering if Brandon has a better workaround for this, or maybe you could magic one up on the spot. Thanks, guys, and keep rocking the great show.
Yes. There, what? Wow. Brought his own sound effects. That's good. Okay, so did you get the question, Brandon?
Yes.
Okay. How can he fix his problem? What do you have any magic for him?
That sounds like a bug because, sorry, that's a little anticlimactic. Basically, Compass does a really good job of keeping a cache of these things most of the time. And so it may be that for some reason his caches aren't being saved properly. I would definitely post to the GitHub issues for Compass and say, hey, what's the deal here? And or actually search him. There may be already a reported issue that someone has solved this for his particular situation. Did he say he was using a specific framework? Because I didn't think he mentioned anything.
I think he said he's using Compass, so I guess it's Compass's spreading thing.
I guess I meant like Rails or something else like that. Because
it didn't say anything specific.
The Rails asset pipeline is kind of wonky, and sometimes it decides to just recompile everything all the time. And so there may be a fix for that. Off the top of my head, I'm not really sure where to direct him, except that shouldn't be happening. So don't spend too much time trying to work around it. I would post to the issues list, and the people who are way smarter than me who developed that will help.
Yeah, that's so interesting. He just has to isolate it into one file to make it.
Oh, it sounds like what he's doing is just compiling it once and then leaving it alone until he changes and then compiling it again. I mean, that's a decent workaround, but it's not supposed to work like that. It's supposed to know that it's already compiled those. Unless something weird is happening on his file system and it's like changing the modified times of those files. And
yeah, maybe his cache isn't working, like his SAS cache.
Right.
Or something.
That's what I suspect, and that may be a known bug. There's something you can do. You could run Compass clean, and it will wipe out all the cache files and then regenerate again, and it might fix whatever is going crazy there, or just delete the .sas-cache file directory.
Hmm. All right. Well, there you go, Brad. Hopefully that works out for you. Awesome. Well, cool. I think we should just keep on rapid firing because we got a ton of questions for you, Brian. So we're just going to keep going here. Here's the one from Louis Van de Croix. I'm not doing it. Okay, here we go.
Hi, guys. First of all, I absolutely love Octopress and Jekyll for that matter. But I do have a question. Why does Jekyll and this Octopress use Ruby and not something like Grunt.js? I know Angular.js switched from Rake to Grunt. Is this something that could happen? Cheers.
So is Octopress going to switch to Grunt in the near future, Brian?
I have no plans to do that, and I doubt. Let's see, I'm trying to decide. So this is a Grunt.js is a JavaScript task runner. I guess this is like a replacement for Rake for JavaScript developers. I'm not sure. Does anybody know?
Yeah, it's you can now like compile Compass from Grunt and it runs on Node.
Oh, right.
So okay. It's just like a Node compiler, I guess. And I don't know if that just hits the Ruby gem or if it has its own special NPM packet or something.
Wildly popular. It's definitely on my level up weekend idea thing. I got to get on it just so I know what's up about it. But anyway, so it doesn't sound like it's going
to
happen.
Well, I think it's actually what we're wanting to do with Octopress is move to a CLI. And so our development right now for 3.0 is getting everything in place to where it's a lot easier to do that. And so we're, you know, moving a lot of stuff out of the Rake file and into the lib. All the configurations are moved out of the Rake file and compiled at runtime. Really, the reason that we're using Ruby at all is that that's what Jekyll uses, and that's what a lot of our plugins use, and it's just a common way of communicating with all of them. I think, you know, historically, Grunt hasn't been around long enough for us to have built anything on top of that from the beginning. So it also has to do with... we started out with Ruby, so that's what we're using.
Yeah, it would seem like because Octopress requires Jekyll, which requires Ruby. So at some point, you're going to have to use Ruby. So why would you interject a JavaScript kind of interface, whether it's still command line or not? But I don't know. Maybe somebody could make that. It's a Grunt task that runs a Rake task.
Well, I mean, we've got a gem file, and you need to install the gems, and they have CLI components as well. So it would be weird to go to NPM to install Octopress and then have to also go over to Ruby gems. I mean, going to all these places to get everything together just seems like a hassle. So we're kind of keeping it in the Ruby world for reasons like that.
And Rake is not so bad. I like Rake. I guess it's the same as Grunt, probably, but yeah. I like it.
And we're actually also moving the compilation stuff to Guard. So Rake is just a command front end for Guard on this new release as well.
Cool. Interesting.
And I get into Guard too. I'm so behind.
Guard is awesome.
Guard's sort of the same thing, right? It's the same sort of asset.
You can give it a...
It watches files. It's all about watching your stuff and doing stuff when stuff changes, which is so it's like CodeKit for Rails or whatever, right? Like
right.
It watches the directory. Oh,
interesting.
Yeah. Okay. Is that good? Are we? There's probably no big reason for Octopress to move to Grunt other than people would be like, I love Grunt, so now I love Octopress. It would like give you free users. Anyway, let's leave that behind. Lucas Grodsky has an interesting question about placeholder selectors in SAS, and I don't know, like a really weird possible way to use them. It's audio. Do you have the audio?
Wait, hold on. Let me see if I have it.
Or is this one of the ones that...
I had two that failed on me. Hold on. Let's see. What was his name again? Sorry.
Lucas Gradsky.
Lucas Gradsky. Dude, I do not have that one. Let's see. Let me... maybe it's this one. I have one more. Should I just roll it and just see what happens?
Well, play the first dice? 2 seconds of it.
Here we go.
Hey guys, recently I have been working on SAS and Compass template.
Is that it? Let's go for it.
Just play it.
Down, where I declare several placeholders and mixins, so later I extend them throughout the starsheet, so I keep the code dry to a maximum. The problem I run into is when I try to extend a placeholder within a media query. I have been looking for some answers, but unfortunately none of them I'm fully satisfied with, as all of the proposed solutions lead to the code multiplication. Any ideas, thoughts, when and if and how SAS is going to deal with extend issue within the media? Thanks a lot. I love the show.
All right.
Was that the question? Did you get it? You feel good? Okay.
I feel amazing.
I can explain.
I don't know why. Do you feel good? Okay. Yeah, basically what he's asking is SAS has a way that you can extend, use a at extend to really just take whatever class names you have and join them together. So if you have, let's say you have alert is a class name, and an alert has some basic styles for some kind of a little pop-up that you're going to have. And then you want to have like alert.error, and you can say .error extends .alert. And so what that'll do is then it'll take, when it compiles, SAS will actually copy the class name for error and put it right next to alert. So now your style sheets, when you declare the styles for the alert, it would say .error.alert, and it would put the common styles there, and then you can have your specific style later.
Mm-hmm. It doesn't repeat all the innards, right. So it's just more efficient in a way.
Now a placeholder, you can use percent alert. And so when you extend that, it will only say dot error and then give the base. And so
it's really similar.
Yeah.
Right.
So
it's just, it doesn't make that first class. That first class doesn't get output.
Yeah. It's a silent class name in a sense. The right. problem really is that extending from within a media query we can't really guarantee that it behaves like people want it to. And so it is not going to be supported by SAS. Because let's say you have class names that are, let's just say in this situation, if an error alert is on a small device, you're using the, let's just say you're using max width because you're crazy. No. if you're doing like media max width, this, and then you have error extend alert, then SAS knows to make any time that the alert placeholder or class name appears anywhere in the style sheet, it will add the error class to that. And so it'll happen out of scope of the media query. It doesn't know that you're trying to say, just make it happen within this media query. Like it's really, or maybe that's what you want. Like we don't know. It really comes down to, we don't know what the author is intending or expecting from this. And so making it right now, it just comes up as an error because we don't want to encourage people to write it that way. It does mean more code, but you're going to have to write it yourself anyway. It's more SAS code, but it's not going to be more CSS.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So there's a reason that this doesn't work, and it feels weird, right? You feel smited by SAS.
Oh yeah, the first time
it's for your own good.
The first time that happened to me, I was like, "Dude, what? This used to work. What's going on?" And they said, "Yeah, you thought it worked, but you didn't really like it. Worked because of the way you wanted to use it, but other people are trying to use it this way, and it's not doing what they want. They want it to be scoped to the media query, and some people want it to be global. And so our best way of dealing with it is saying, don't do that.
You can't do it.
Yeah. I mean, you can imagine people, right? It bubbles out the actual selector. So if it bubbles out that selector outside of the media query, that's weird. There's, you know, who knows? So that was a good explanation of why that is. In other news, though, Lucas's example code here, which I might explain, is really weird. It's kind of like opposite CSS. So he has all these. Imagine a placeholder for every single different CSS property and value that you could have. So there's a placeholder selector called disN, and there's a placeholder selector called disB. And what the first one is display none, and the other one is display block. And then
Chris,
you write.
I got bad news for you. You're breaking up.
It's okay. You'll hear me in the recording.
So he's got He's got different kind of like properties for like, he'll have like percent dis dash N for display none, percent dis dash B for display block, percent dis I for display inline. So here you go. It's you see where I'm going with this.
Yes.
So when he's like at media min width 320 pixels, he wants P extend percent dis B, right? So he wants it to display block. I mean, this is just his example, right? Like it probably is more complicated than this, but like at this point you could just write CSS, right?
I would, yeah. And honestly, that is not the way that placeholder selectors are meant to be used. I think that's going to end up being a lot harder to maintain. If you think about the way that your SAS is going to be generated, if you do that, every single selector that has display none that extends that is going to be piled up there. So when you go to your web inspector in your dev tools or whatever, so let's say you're in Chrome dev tools and you're looking at why is this thing display none? You're going to see a page long of class names before you find the one that you're looking for. It's just, you shouldn't use extends that way, really. It's just like, just write this. It'd be harder to maintain too, because you know, you go to some style that you want to change and you just see it extending all these things that don't look like CSS and they're all custom named. It's like, well, if I delete this, what all am I deleting? Because then you have to go over and find out what was this extending. Whereas if you use really verbose class names that have large groups of styles, you know, that's how you do modular style sheets anyway. And it's really meant to make that part easier.
And that's where I was going with it in my head, is like, don't focus on like these over optimizing kind of code snippets, because that's kind of what at least his example is trying to do, right? Like these code snippets. I just type add extend dis B and that displays block, you know. I would focus on what does the whole module need to do, and then like you're gonna have some repetition, but it'll be human readable. You won't have to like find this guy and then run back up like 10 files to go find the other, what that whatever that placeholder meant or whatever. So I don't know. His example is very, very simplified, maybe over reduced in this situation.
Yeah, it seems more like if you got tired of, like, let's say you're typing a book and you got tired of using the word and all the time. So you came up with a variable for that and you placed it in place of that. It's like, people are not going to be able to read that, or it's just going to be weird.
Right. Like all these and thus are triangles now, just because I'm sick of typing that. Yeah. Yeah. I guess you got to be careful, huh?
That's a terrible example that I just came up with.
I'm all.
But thanks for going with it. I really appreciate the support.
I will run with any analogy. That's the first thing you learn in broadcasting school. Which I don't attend. All right. Shoot. This is fun. All right. Okay. So one more question here. And then we had actually a last minute question that we need to get to. But Nguyen, I murder last names. Anyway, wrote in, said, I have a quick question about using media queries in SAS. Should I group my media queries according to breakpoint? That is, have all the properties and selectors that apply for that breakpoint together at the bottom of the CSS file? Or should I group them according to selectors? That is, have different media queries that belong to the same selector be in the same place? Does that make sense? So should I just dump them at the bottom of my file, kind of, or should I nest them with my selectors? Do you have any thoughts on
that? I'd say,
how do you do it?
It depends on what you're doing, but I kind of use a combination of different approaches. For one thing, I like to split out my my style sheets so that I have, like, for example, I have a layout style sheet, and that kind of determines the main template for my whole site. And so in there, I'm trying not to use anything like color. I'm just using, you know, maybe some margin padding and widths and things like that. And then I have a bunch of media queries for those layout elements there. And so you'll have like your wrappers or your container divs all in this with all of their layout styles. And so to me, it's much better to use the media queries in line on that rather than putting them at the bottom of some, you know, because I mean, I also have lots of different style sheets. I'm not doing it all in one. And so the bottom of which one should I put it in? Like the last one that's imported and why there? Because I don't know. I think it's a lot easier to keep things in line. And so, you know, especially because for readability, so let's say that I have main, you know, .main or whatever has some nice chunky, like 40 pixels of padding. But then as you get smaller, so then I'll say, I do it the other way. So let's, it would have, so, you know,
you start small,
right. 10 pixels of padding. And then as you get, you know, really wide, like a 1280 or something, then it's got 40 pixels of padding. And having that all together allows me to immediately see, this is the layout of main is doing for each of these media queries. And so when I want to change, you know, as I'm thinking about it, I look at my site and I'm like, okay, I want to change this specific attribute of this container at different media queries. I can go to one place and know where that is. Otherwise, I have to go all over the place to find what happens there. Mm-hmm. And I will add one thing that's really cool that I've been doing lately with, I don't know if you guys have experimented with the content mix-ins, how you can use content in a mix-in. Have you done that?
No, I don't think. Okay, I have.
So like, if you use a mix-in, you can actually pass a content block into it, kind of like any other block. So you'd say include. I have one, for example, that is at least, and I use that to map to media queries for min width. And so I'll say,
you know, okay, yeah, I have seen this start happening. Okay, go ahead.
So I'll say include at least, and then give it a variable name for a width. So I might have, you know, phone small. And so it'd be like 320 pixels is what that maps to wherever I set my variables in my layout file. And so I'll say, yeah, include at least phone width and then open bracket. And then inside of that, I'll put the styles that I want for a phone. Then I can do, you know, close bracket. And I can do include at least tablet. And then I can give tablet styles or whatever. And then I also, so the other one I have is in until. And what those end up doing is those render the media queries. And now in SAS, you can variableize your media queries. And so they take the phone width and they apply it. So at media screen and min width, whatever that variable is, open bracket, then at content. And what that does is it puts those styles in the media query in line where you're using it.
So this is similar, but a little more advanced than Chris's mama bear, baby bear.
Wow. I just hopped in and I really like the idea of at least and at most.
Actually called it until, but at most sounds pretty good. So that's a nice way of doing that. And the other cool thing is there was a 24 ways post about using picks to M's so that if you do columns, you can say one column is this many pixels and then you do picks to M. To convert that to M's, you know, you tell it base 16 pixels, and then you can just say media queries are how many columns. And so, so you can be like column times three. And so you don't have to think about sizes anymore. If you're into using that kind of thing.
Yeah.
I think pixels is a weird thing in that a lot of us just, we have in our minds what pixels are because we've been using them for so long. So we like go out of the way to make sure that we can keep thinking in pixels, but then convert it to what we need it to be. And I think that's just like a temporary thing. I think designers coming up these days will use pixels less and they just won't have this like mental model of what pixels are. And maybe.
Especially, I think when REMs take over, we'll be able to see more clearly if that works. It'd be pretty hard to get rid of pixels for things like borders and stuff like that, I'd imagine.
Yeah, you may be right. And there's... JavaScript will just speaks in pixels for the most part. So that's...
It's interesting. Like, I ran into a problem recently where I was given an asset with an odd number dimensions, you know, and I was doing like some rotating on it and it gets all weird. You see a shift because it's like doing some subpixel calcs. Like, but if you specify an even number of pixels, it like it rotates just fine. So it's this even weird. I agree with you, Chris, that pixels are getting weird because it's like, well, odd pixels don't even count anymore. Those are stupid because they're totally undependable in subpixel, you know, layouts. So it's weird. I don't know. Pixels are weird.
Yeah, then there's the whole floating Man. And divisions thing, and yeah, pixels, they're terrible.
Yeah. Hey.
Down with pixels. Yeah,
arbitrary. I hate Get pixels, my too. Line. Stupid pixels.
I do love the idea of handling your media queries with M's, because resizing a browser, like, you know, zooming it, I guess is what I mean to say, allows you to show the content in a way that doesn't look crazy. You know, it'll
temporary thing too, though. It's just like a bug, kind of. So it's worth doing now, setting all your media queries in M's, just because of that little zooming bug thing. But like, that was only WebKit anyway. Like Firefox, even if your media queries are in pixels, when you zoom in, they will take effect like they should.
Oh yeah, the other reason was that device pixels are weird with some Android phones. And so if you set media queries or you set certain things with pixels, then your fonts get really tiny and everything else looks really big. There's all kinds of weird things that happen. I remember reading about that, but I could be wrong. I don't know what the latest is on that.
Yeah. iPad mini really, really sealed the deal, right? So like if you load a page on the iPad mini and the iPad, they'll render exactly the same, only the mini was really short. So now like this idea of, well, pixels are just normalized, you know, like a pixels, it's always the same, like about the same physical width on a screen. Like, well, that's not true.
Nope.
Well, even densities and stuff. I mean, like the Chromebook Pixel, there you go, is like a retina screen. And so is like the Surface, but they can't use the word retina. You know, they didn't brand it first, so they don't win. And then people are like, don't treat them as retina devices, but they are, you know.
But the name like Pixel, you kind of wish it had like an 8-bit browsing mode or something.
That's what I expected. I was like, oh, finally.
Yeah, for real.
Finally. Just the Super Mario Brothers of browser, of computers. So, Chris, do you want to run another ad?
The RWD Summit is coming up. It's our longtime sponsor, Environments for Humans. So the URL is rwdsummit.com. It's coming up. It's online, so you can attend it from anywhere in the world, April 16th through 18th. It's 3 days, 3 tracks, first day. Performance, second day strategy, third day technical. Pick the track you want and just go that day or go all the days. I think Dave's the last day if you want to see Dave. Get 20% off as you're checking out with the discount code ShopTalk. And they have tickets for businesses too. So I think a lot of you probably work at a company who has some kind of budget for sending people to conferences. One, this is a lot cheaper because you don't have to get on a plane. You don't have to even take off work, really. You can just put your computer up on a screen and like rent a couch or something and you all can watch it because they have tickets that are for kind of like displaying this thing at a business. So I think that's pretty cool. I hope to jump in and watch some of it because their online conferences are really good. There's a lot of engagement, a lot of chat that happens because it's, you know, it's like the Shop Talk chat room, people actually talking. So RWD Summit, it's going to be sweet. Please attend it, rwdsummit.com. Yay.
Well, cool. We have another question, an audio question. This was that last minute question that came in from a Caleb Mathis, I believe.
What does Dave, what is, like, what is Dave Rupert?
Well, what is that? What now?
What is Dave Rupert, I said.
Dave Rupert is a man that is going to be on the podcast with me.
No, like, what's the one that lives outside and never comes in a place?
What are you talking about?
I'm talking about, like, a plant that lives outside. He's a plant.
What?
Yes, he is a plant. I think that's him. He's a plant.
Okay, thanks,
so,
Caleb.
I think he answered his own question, actually, but...
Yeah, It turned out to kind of not be a question.
This might just be some information that you need to know about Dave. Apparently you're a plant that's outside awesome. Of our house.
Okay, that's good. I'll take that. I'll do that.
Oh. So that 4 years old is a kind of awesome age for logic.
Oh, yes. We have so much fun.
That's ridiculous. Dave Ruby, he's going to be on a podcast with
him. He's going to be on the podcast. He's a plant, Dad.
How? That's crazy. Anyway.
We're doing a great job for being a plant, I got to tell you.
Hey, yeah. I'm pretty successful.
You probably make more than most plants.
For being a plant. Well, plants make oxygen. I don't really do that. Yeah. Well, there you go. Well, do we have time for one more question? Are we all ready for one more here? Let's see. I'm going to try to find one that we can do. Here we go. Here we go. Okay, so Tim Evco wrote in and asked, first, a few weeks ago, I was browsing the web in IE6 using BrowserStack just to get a feel of how big websites deal with browsers that suck. I came across CSS tricks and I noticed that it looks like the style sheets are simply turned off for older browsers. I was wondering how this was achieved, as I'd like to implement the same functionality for my portfolio site, HTTP Tim Evco. Secondly, do you guys use any HTML preprocessors like Haml? I use Sass for my CSS, but I haven't looked into anything for HTML. What are the pros and cons? Thanks in advance. So, two questions. How do you disable style sheets for browsers that suck, quote unquote? And then, are you guys using Haml? Chris, maybe you should answer the CSS tricks one.
Well, there was I don't know if you guys remember, but there's that Andy Clark universal IE6 style sheet thing that became popular mm-hmm. for a little while. Essentially, IE has conditional style sheets. You can say, if IE less than 7 or whatever, then do this. And, or, you know, you can write logic in literally like HTML comments for content to show up only for certain versions of IE. This is gone in IE10, but all previous versions of IE supported them. So you could write the logic in such a way that like serve my main style sheet to this browser, but serve this like generally stripped down, basically a print style sheet to older versions of IE. And that's what I've done on CSS tricks. Like, you get a little bit of style, but just like a really basic, like basically print style sheet through that conditional logic.
It's funny because they probably implemented that so that people could add cool ActiveX stuff. Like, they're like, oh, we're gonna have all this proprietary stuff, but we don't want it to break everyone's web browsing experience, so we'll let them use it in a condition. And now people are doing the opposite. It's like, yeah, you get the leftovers. Everyone else gets to sit at the big table.
Yeah. Well, it's kind of good that they did it, because we needed it for a long time. So I don't have a problem with it. And they did the right thing by removing it in 10. So I think they're doing all the right stuff. I don't know about all this.
I'm envious of the people who have dropped support of older IEs, but I'll get onto that another day, I guess.
That's one of the things I love about working at MongoHQ is it's because we have such a developer-centered audience, people who have logged in with IE are less than like half of 1%. And it's almost all like the latest version of Chrome or Safari, sometimes Firefox.
Yeah.
Awesome.
CodePen.
Yep.
So Haml, Mark Haml, Luke Skywalker. Yeah.
What is up with Haml?
Are you guys using it? I've used it on a project, but I found myself like getting most of the way down the tree and then just having to write HTML. Like, and they're like, you know, you can just write HTML convenience function kind of thing. So I don't know. What do you guys think?
I have never given it any of them a proper, like a hardcore go. Like, I've used Jade a little bit. I'm familiar with them. But I seem to get the least amount of value out of the HTML one.
So I used to use Haml all the time. It's actually how I got introduced to Sass back when it was all indented and there were no SCSS syntax. And recently I have made the switch to Slim, which you should definitely check it out. Slim is very like Haml in that it uses indentation and it's nice for that. But you can also just write regular HTML tags and it'll do what you expect it to do with that, which is cool. The difference is you don't have to use percents for general tags. It just assumes anything you're typing is a tag. So with Haml, you had to wait for them to add support. I guess no, maybe you didn't. There were things with like, I think there were things with HTML5 tags not being recognized right away. And they had to patch that. But I could be remembering incorrectly. I will say though, with Slim, if you wanted to have just text on a line, you have to start with a pipe, which is a little bit less awesome. But if I were going to...
But that's the same as YAML or anything.
Oh, yeah. Like that, yeah. I mean, it's...
Yeah.
I would definitely say check out Slim right now. I'm loving that. Cause you can do, I mean, if you're not using, Ruby though, you're not going to enjoy it because it does require Ruby to compile. But if you're like in the Rails world, yeah, go for Slim.
Great, man. Now we're going to get, is there a grunt task for Slim next? Oh boy. Okay. No, that's good. I haven't actually looked into Slim. It looks pretty nice.
It's nice, and it has a lot of good.
It is nice.
It uses tilt for all the filters, so you can do like colon markdown, or maybe it's markdown colon, and then just write it out, and then whatever tilt is using for its markdown processor will work. It's pretty cool.
I like that. I like that. Well, awesome. I think we should probably wrap it up. I wanted to say the chat room, I think, deciphered your son.
Oh, yeah.
I think so. I forget who said it, but somebody was saying maybe he thought you said Dave Rhubarb, and maybe he thinks rhubarb is a plant that's outside.
Mm.
Or I forget what the other one was, but anyway.
Yeah. Anyway. We thought maybe also, I don't know, for some reason he thought your name sounded like Crepe Myrtle, but that's what we were going with because we don't have any rhubarb. But
that's good. Yeah. And then Remy Bach in the chat room said, it beats being a vegetable.
Oh.
But wow.
Because beets are vegetable.
Yeah, that was terrible, Remy. All right. How do you sleep at night? Okay.
Don't lie.
Brandon, thanks so much for coming on the show. How do people follow you, get in touch with you, give you money? How does that work?
So I am iMathis pretty much everywhere. That would be on GitHub, Twitter, app.net, GitTip, if you wanted to give me money. And also I have BrandonMathis.com, which is a site that I haven't updated in a long time. Just because I've been too busy building other people's blogs and not working on
it's my called own. The static site curse. I find that people that move to static sites then immediately stop blogging.
Yeah.
I know nothing of this.
It's funny because I've spent more time working on the documentation for Octopress than my own blog just because it feels like, oh, this is more important. I'm helping more people with this. So, yeah. Anyway, but that's where I am.
Cool. Awesome. And thanks for clearing up iMathis and Ima This.
Yeah. Now you know how to say it.
That's good. Thanks, everyone, for coming out in the chat room. You guys are wonderful, wonderful people. You make the world go round. And follow Shop Talk at Shop Talk Show on Twitter. And buy a t-shirt. We're actually going to be beefing up the store, so save up your money. Chris, you got anything?
ShopTalkShow.com.